From New York City, the survival capital of the world, this is Starship One Radio, successor to Radio Doomsday Live. We're the cosmic superforce in broadcasting, Starship One Radio. It's a new program building on the success of Radio Doomsday Live, which started about a year ago, and which is very much oriented toward Mayan calendar end date and the activities leading up to that. And now we continue with Starship One Radio, and tonight it's my privilege to have with me a remote viewer by the name of Paul H. Smith, who worked very, very closely with Ingo Swann. In fact, he was trained by Ingo Swann in the art of remote viewing, which is a term that Ingo Swann, who just recently passed away, coined. And with us, together with Paul and myself, is Mark Brinkerhoff, who knew Ingo Swann and met regularly with him for a period of about 20 years. Mark is a UFO contactee, a friend of mine. We go all the way back. And we're going to be basically paying tribute to Ingo Swann and his contributions in the area of remote viewing. Before I go into that, however, I want to update you on some news developments. Some of the latest things that we should be aware of and concerned about. For one thing, here in New York, the survival capital of the world, now we're faced with a blizzard condition, which they're saying could bring up to a foot of snow or more. Now, what's important here is that the entire Northeast apparently will be affected. And in Moscow, for your information, it's been 100 years since there's been this kind of weather disturbance in Moscow. So something is very, very unusual, because these storms are coming up way too regularly and something is behind it. And that's one of the things I'm going to want to ask Paul Smith about in just a few minutes. Now, also heading our way next week on February 15th is a asteroid half the size of a football field, which could cause tremendous devastation if it ever hit Earth. It's not expected to hit Earth, but what's kind of alarming is that it's going to be going beneath, traveling beneath the satellites. So it's going to be a pretty close situation with this asteroid. And I'm going to want to ask Paul his view on this, too, and whether we have anything to be concerned about. I guess that pretty much wraps up the introduction. So why don't we go right into discussion with Paul Smith on how he got into the field of remote viewing and how he met Ingo Swann and what Ingo's contribution was to the field. I'd like to welcome you, Paul, to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I just that question. The question basically is, how did you meet Ingo, and how long did you know him?
Okay. Well, that's easy, actually. I didn't even know Ingo Swann existed in July of 1983.
Mm-hmm.
In August of 1983, I was approached to join a Black Army intelligence program,
okay,
which at that time was known as Center Lane. I had no idea what the program was about, mm-hmm, but I did the test. I took the test they wanted me to, and they said, well, come on over, we'll read you on and see if you're willing to volunteer. And I'm thinking, volunteer for what?
Yeah.
So I go over, they sit me down, and they said, first of all, I had to sign all these non-disclosure forms, you know, and I kind of call it my Men in Black moment, because it was like that point in the first Men in Black movie where Tommy Lee Jones has Will Smith there, and he basically tells him that he has to sever all personal ties, he'll have his fingerprints erased, all kinds of these, you know, he just basically
right.
Talks out of society, right?
Yes.
Well, it wasn't quite that bad, but it was kind of along those lines. I couldn't even, if I joined the program, I couldn't even tell people who didn't already know that I was in the Army.
How are you able to talk about this now?
It was declassified in 1995.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, the guy sits me down at the table. He says, okay, so what we do is we collect intelligence against foreign threats using a parapsychology discipline known as remote viewing. We want to know if you'd be willing to volunteer to become a psychic spy. And
how
I
did they know that you had this ability? How did they choose you?
Well, they didn't know whether I had the ability or not, but they knew roughly what a profile of a successful remote viewer looked like. They would be a successful military officer. They would have had decent efficiency reports. They would have had above average intelligence, competence in their field, that kind of thing. And then, in addition, have a further interest that's fairly unique for military officers, an interest in some kind of right brain kind of activity, such as painting, drawing, music, something like that, right?
Creative individual.
Yes. They discovered that I had actually majored in art in college. I'd played guitar for many years. I wrote short stories that usually got rejected. So they knew I was doing those kinds of things. And they thought, well, we'll give him these assessment tests, see how he does, and if he scores where we want him to. And they were mostly standard psychology tests, Myers-Briggs, type inventory, MMPI, things like that, then we'll pitch him and see if he wants to do it. Well, I did, and that started the ball rolling. And so now I get to how I met Ingo Swann. Remote viewing itself was actually invented by Ingo Swann back in 1971, and through a process that maybe we'll get into later. But he came, the CIA became aware of him and his capabilities, they had a contract with a government think tank, Stanford Research Institute, and a scientist named Hal Puthoff. The two of them got together and formed the core of what became the research part of the military remote viewing program. I'm sorry?
No, could you just describe what it was that you were taught by Ingo? The process?
Yeah, actually, let me get to how I met Ingo, because that segues right into what we learned.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we segue up to 1983. I'm now in the program. The Army had a contract with Stanford Research Institute, with SRI, with Hal Puthoff and Ingo Swann, to teach a bunch of military officers this remote viewing skill. And so in January of 1984, we flew out to Menlo Park, California. And that was my first meeting with Ingo Swann, and he proceeded to teach us the process over the next year. And what he taught us, essentially, and I'm going to use some words here that are not exact, but we don't have exact words for it. In a way, you project your consciousness to a distant site or location, and you collect information, you have experiences, impressions about that location, and then you report those back by sketching and describing verbally. It doesn't have to just be a location. It can be an event, distant in time. It can be a person. It can be anything like that. It's a form of clairvoyance in a way, but there's more to it. A good example of what we'd do, for example, let's say there's a facility on the far side of the Ural Mountains. This is back in the old Soviet Union days. And the CIA didn't know exactly what was going on in there. They knew it might be one of three things. It could be a biological chemical warfare facility. They could be making a new nuclear weapon. Or maybe it was a main battle tank development facility, something like that. They didn't know which one it was, but they knew it was one of those three. Then they might ask the remote viewers, okay, we're not going to tell you anything about this. We want you to go inside. We want you to look around and put quotes around that word look, right? Look around, and we want you to tell us what you perceive in there to see if we can find out something about this. And let's say the remote viewer goes in, he says, well, these huge containers, they're full of this green viscous liquid, and the liquid is meant to be spread out across the landscape and hurt people. Well, now the CIA knows it's a chemical warfare facility, right? So that's kind of very briefly how we use this.
Okay. Describe some of the experiments, if you will, that Ingo was involved with, and what would you say his rate of success was?
Let me answer that question first. What his rate of success was, I actually don't have access to, because a lot of that research happened out in California, and we in the military program didn't have direct access to it.
Okay.
Somewhere there is a building or a room with all of that information in it. I'd love to get my hands on it. I do know that the things I've seen him do is he had fairly close to 100% success measured in terms of what is possible with this. And he didn't always get it right. Nobody always gets it right because it's the human system is a fallible system. But he did some very remarkable things.
Okay, what were a few of those?
Okay, let me give you an example of the first experiment he did with Hal Puthoff. He was invited out to California from New York. He lived in New York, actually, right? You're in Manhattan, is that where you're at?
Yes, I am, yes.
Yeah. He lived down on the Bowery, right?
That's right.
He had a building down there, and he was invited out from New York to California to do an experiment. And what Hal Puthoff did was he made arrangements with the physics department at Stanford to access a quark detector, this huge magnetometer embedded in the floor in the basement of the Varian Science Building or Physics Building there at Stanford. And the point was, Ingo had some reputation as being able to use psychokinesis to affect sensitive instruments like this. So Hal's original idea was that Ingo would come down, he would stand outside the range of where he could affect it, and then he would use his mind to affect the piece of equipment. So he gets him down there. It's buried in the floor. Ingo says, "Where's the machine?" Hal says, "It's buried in the floor." Ingo says, "How the heck am I going to influence this thing? I don't even know where it's at." He said, "Here, let me try something." So Ingo then proceeds to say, "Let me look at it." Hal says, "You can't look at it. It's buried in the floor." Ingo says, no, that's not what I mean." He gets he takes a pen, and he starts drawing on a piece of paper nearby, and he essentially remote views, uses ESP, to see, again, I put that in quotes, see the inside of this device, which no one has ever, it had never been published before. He accurately sketches the inside of it, and Puthoff, who's a physicist himself, is going, "What? How the heck is he doing that?" You know?
Right.
In the process of him sketching that, the readout on the machine went crazy. And this was a machine that was designed to be imperturbable from the outside because they were trying to detect quarks, and they couldn't be affected by your average thing where it messed up the experiment. And yet Ingo was here actually clearly affecting it in some way because it only reacted when he focuses attention on it.
I understand that some of these experiments were so interesting. The results were so interesting that he became almost like he was referred to at one point as a psychic guinea pig.
Well, actually, he objected to that. The problem
sure
is he started doing experiments out in New York City at the City College of New York and at the American Society of Psychical Research. He worked with a couple of fairly legendary folks in the field, Gertrude Schmeidler, who was at the City College of New York, and Carlos Osis, who was at the ASPR.
Mm-hmm.
He also did some work with Cleve Baxter, who had a laboratory there in New York. Cleve was famous because he was one of the pioneers of polygraphy, of lie detectors. The CIA actually still contracted with him. He's in his 80s, up until at least, last I heard, a couple of years ago. They still consulted with him. Anyway, Ingo worked with those folks starting about 1969, and he at first they treated him just like your standard research subject. You come in, you sit down, you do what you're told, do this, do that, do the other thing, and essentially you are a guinea pig. And Ingo really didn't like that. He said, "This is not the way it ought to be. You ought to be treating your subjects as research partners, not as guinea pigs. I mean,
right.
We're not a piece of equipment. We are actually the talent that you guys need to make your experiments a success."
Yeah.
So he started actually partnering and making suggestions, which is how remote viewing actually got invented. He said, "You're doing these experiments wrong. You got to do it this way." And he kind of laid out a new pattern that had never been tried before in the lab, and it turned out to be a huge success. I'm sorry, you wanted to ask something.
Well, no. I obviously Ingo is a highly talented, unusual individual. I was just wondering, how much was Ingo paid for his participation in these experiments by the CIA or by the government? Do you have any idea?
You know, unfortunately, I don't. He never was particularly forthcoming with that. You know, and in fact, I'm sure that all is a matter of record somewhere, but at the time, that whole contract thing was classified.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't been able to find those old records yet, even though they declassified a lot of stuff. But
how do you feel about the nature of the work in the sense that, you know, now he's working, in effect, for the CIA, and you never know what that information is going to be used for exactly. Was he okay with that, or was he concerned about that in any way?
Yeah, Inga was very patriotic, actually. In fact, he had written a book. He was very concerned about the foreign communist threat, and he wrote a book called "What Will Happen to You When the Russians Take Over?"
Okay.
Kind of. Mm-hmm. Hypothesized that the Soviets were to overrun the United States, how they would treat various classes of people.
Right.
And did a lot of research of how they had behaved in other countries, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he was very patriotic, but that doesn't mean he would do something that was irresponsible. And my experience was that the CIA, the Army, the Defense Intelligence Agency, those folks never used this in a way that I felt was inappropriate. We really were focused pretty much on foreign threats.
Are they not using it anymore, Paul?
If they are, they're not telling anybody. In 1995,
Is that because they're not, you know, that they didn't consider it successful in some way?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. When they shut the program down in 1995, and the reason it was shut down is because the people who were at that point in charge of it, you know, higher up the chain of command, were pretty much skeptics. They kind of had this attitude that this is the kind of thing I wouldn't believe even if it was true. You know, in fact, there's a famous quote from someone who was asked to review some of this research, who said that very thing. In fact, the director of the CIA at the time the program was closed was Robert Deutsch, who has become famous for kicking anybody out of his office who tried to give him a briefing on remote viewing. He was I think I'm right about this, he was a nuclear physicist by training and very skeptical about anything that you couldn't measure, you know. And so he was very much opposed to it.
Yes, you're the head of an organization called Remote Viewing Instructional Services.
Uh-huh.
Tell my listeners what that's about, and how does the average person, how can the average person use remote viewing for business purposes or for almost for anything else?
Okay. Well, that would take the rest of the hour, but I'll summarize.
Okay.
Remote Viewing Instructional Services is actually my own private company commercially training people in the same skill that I learned from Ingo Swann when he trained us.
Mm-hmm.
And so people now, since they've declassified it, can actually learn those very same things that we learn in the military. And how you apply that, I mean, there's any number of ways you can. And a lot of people, I guess probably the best way to answer is to tell you why people take my training.
Okay.
People say, well, why do people want to learn remote viewing? And I say there's all kinds of reasons. One is that some folks want to try and do what I call forensic remote viewing. They want to try and help police solve cases. They may want to try and find missing kids. Some people want to use investing, and there is a way of applying it that actually has proven to be very successful. People have made thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of dollars using it.
Have you done it? Have you used it for that purpose?
I've made money with it. Yeah.
You have.
It's not a silver bullet. I mean, you have to do some work to make it work. But in fact, there's a couple of science papers being published about people who have made significant amounts of money using remote viewing. They've written up the results. It's been peer reviewed, and it's now going to be published in the next few months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
Before I let you go, I wanted to ask you regarding this asteroid that's coming our way on February 15th. Do you have any feelings about that? You know, whether we have anything really to be concerned about, other than the fact that we're going to get a fairly close glimpse of an asteroid.
You know, to coin a phrase, this wasn't even on my radar till this afternoon. I hadn't heard anything about it, and I wasn't really paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I really haven't even had a chance to think about it.
Let me ask you about Planet X. I assume you're aware of this planet, this theoretical planet anyway. I think it's a real planet. It also was known by the ancients as Nibiru. There's been a lot of publicity about it lately, particularly with the countdown to the end date in the Mayan calendar, and whether or not Planet X was had entered the inner solar system and was barreling toward Earth. Do you have any feelings about that?
You know, one of the things that's interesting about my experience in remote viewing is that I absolutely believe that ESP works. Absolutely believe it. I've seen it happen too many times. But it's also made me a bit skeptical about other things that you don't have real evidence for, you know. And
right.
So I'm not going to rule out that Nibiru exists, but I'm pretty skeptical about it. I have to say that.
Okay. And so you don't see it in your mind's eye, anything like that, any kind of a body or a comet from space coming toward Earth in this general time frame?
Well, I haven't had any portents about that.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Now, yeah, so.
Okay. And what is your website if people want to learn how they can avail themselves of your services?
Yes, thank you. It's www.rviewer.com. That's the letter R and then the word viewer. So RVIEWER.com.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much. Paul H. Smith, a remote viewer and friend of longtime friend and associate of Ingo Swann, the man who invented the term remote viewing and made it famous. Thanks very much, Paul.
You are quite welcome.
Okay. Okay, and now we're going to be joined by Mark Brinkerhoff, an old friend of mine who is a UFO contactee, a fellow artist like Ingo Swann was also did some stunning pictures. In fact, if you go to the VBS Radio website, you'll see a couple of those paintings that Ingo did. They're astonishing. And I'd like to talk to Mark, particularly because Mark was involved with Ingo, knew him for about 20 years and met with him fairly regularly, and certainly had, I'm sure, a sense of what his perspective was overall. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Mark.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing? Could you tell my listeners how you, first came to meet Ingo?
Well, actually at a friend's house, our friend Shala Mattingly.
Right, okay.
And she knew Ingo for a while and set up the meeting. And when we met, it was just amazing. I hope some of the viewers or listeners know about reincarnation or other lifetimes, let's say, from another time period. And I had recognized Ingo from 1971 or 2 from a magazine article I had from a science magazine. So I sensed that I knew him from some other time.
Right.
And I would tell people someday I'll meet him, but I never knew when or how.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was early 1990s that Shala, who was a friend of ours, through Bryce Bond as well, our old friend of mine, set up the meeting. So she had a little mini party and invited us, and Ingo came. And when I met Ingo, it was like a flashback to another time, meeting somebody you knew before, almost like my father, a feeling like that. And I said to him when we hugged, and I said, "I'm so happy to see you and meet you again." And he said, "He said the same. He said me too." So at that moment, there was a connection, and we sat down, and he looked through my book, and I went to go make some tea for us in Shala's kitchen. So he was looking at my book with the UFO photos, and I didn't know he was looking through it. I just set it on the table near him, was going to go get tea and come back. So he looks through them, and I didn't know, and I come back and sit down, and he's closing the book, and I'm going, a notebook with photos and things. And I said, "Oh, I didn't know you were going to look through that. I thought maybe you want me to point to something and say where that was taken." And he says, "Oh, that's no need." He said, I've gone through it all, and it's great, you know. And I said, "Oh." And he flips open to a picture I had of the pastels and of the encounters of the beings I've met. And this goes into future selves, some of this information, which I don't always share, but it was a pastel of the aspect of myself when I'm out of body, or astral soul traveling, as I call
it. And what are these beings, these pictures look like? I've seen some, but just describe them for the listeners.
These beings that I've encountered,
yes,
they're, when I was 5 years old, physically encountered with them, and then also through other dimensional encounters as well, look like masters or angelic beings. If you could imagine a perfected being, that's what they look like. 7, 8 feet, sometimes 9 feet tall. Kind of androgynous. There are males and female, yet they look kind of as androgynous in their essence, the males and the females. They're beautiful. They're perfected.
Mm-hmm.
And they're love. It's pure love. They can have any shade of hair, any shade of eye coloring, and any shade of skin tones. The ones I've met seem to have bronze and gold tones, but after being with them, I've seen other looks, from pale skin to white skin to dark, dark skins, and beautiful beings, elongated eyes, and telepathic, totally. But they can speak, talk with their mouth, but they are mostly telepathic, so you would hear them speaking.
Did Ingo have, did he relate to it in the sense of, had he himself experienced any of the same type of beings at any time?
He experienced some contact, well, I won't say exact contact, but I'm not surprised if he did, in his encounters with secret societies, I guess we'd say. I didn't want to say anything about, you know, I mean what Paul and they were involved with, but there was other things that Ingo was involved with.
Right.
So he speaks about it in the book Penetration, of his encounter, of not encountering, but seeing a woman in California, in Los Angeles, and a very tall woman at a vegetable stand in a grocery store.
And he thought that she was an alien.
No, he sensed it, it was acknowledged later by the people with him who were part of the group that was with him underground that were watching him. But that's in the book Penetration. People can see that maybe online as well.
Yes.
So he spoke. She was tall, beautiful, perfected-looking girl.
Mm-hmm.
But he just felt to look at her, and he was feeling her energy. He told us this originally, my wife and I. So he said, she was beautiful. She was ultimately gorgeous. He says it was like you can't believe what she looked like. And he's 6 foot or so or more, wearing hardly anything, certainly like little short shorts and a blouse, you know, but she was perfected. So he said, I never saw a woman look like this. So he was studying her. And then he tried to not make any contact or eye contact with her. That was his intuitive ability with that. And then he was told by one of the people that he used to call the twins, who ended up one of the men that was watching him back in the time when they were studying him for the Psi information underground, secret underground. He saw him there, and he said that he went over to the guy, and he says, what, are you following me now? That's over, you know. And he says, no, we're not following you, we're following her.
Okay.
So it was that whole thing. So it went into don't make eye contact. Sometimes these beings are bio-androids, and they know psychics would be, if they attuned to them, they would be dangerous to them because they would let people know that they're not humans. So that's most of what Bingo told us about that experience. But in the past, I'm sure he's had some kind of experience, because even at lectures, when you give lectures at times, they will come to a lecture, and they'll be in human form.
Yeah,
but there's something about their aura and their energy that tells you telepathically they're talking to you.
Yes.
So
and by the way, Ingo came.
Yes,
Ingo came to a UFO convention, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the War of the Worlds that I put on in Times Square quite a number of years ago. I didn't even realize he was in the audience, but he was, along with Zechariah Sitchin, also showed up in the audience there. It was quite an interesting event. Now, I understand in Penetration, the same book, which you can't get a hold of, it's very hard to get, that he talks about alien bases that he visualized on the moon.
Yeah, he remote viewed for Mr. Axelrod, quote, the name that he used. Mr. Axelrod was the only time that man used that name for him. And he said, of course, it's after that was over, was declassified, doesn't exist anymore, was not a real name, was just using a name.
Uh-huh.
That's how what connected Ingo and I at that meeting at Shala's house was, when we talked about things about out of body or astral projection, or I call it soul travel. So I had told Ingo, when he had said, you know, about remote viewing, I said, you know, I found it wonderful because I'd been to the moon when I was 5 years old out of body or astral traveling or so.
Mm.
I wanted to go there. I checked it out, and I saw that it was inside, it was a base. And Ingo says, oh, tell me what you saw. So I told him of humanoid beings and aliens, and they were working there. And I actually told this to my father, but this is back in 1958. So I told my father, the moon's hollow. It's not, it's just used as a base. And the moon's Mars as well, and some of the other moons like Ganymede and of the other planets, and Titan. So there's different moons that are used as bases, which I've been to, let's say, dimensionally, through dimensional travel.
Yes.
So when I saw that, I said, went to the other side. When I was on board the ship in 1958, they took me to the moon. We went around the moon. Then we went off towards Saturn, and then back again. So it was like teleporting out and coming back. So I got to see different
Mark,
places.
Was this like an out-of-body experience?
No, this was real. This was the 1958 when I was on board with them, and they carried me.
Well, how, for example, do they deal with, or does a human being like yourself deal with the G-forces and the normal things of physics? I mean, their physics undoubtedly is highly advanced, but still, I mean, human beings on board a craft, it seemed to me that it could present some problems.
Well, they showed one thing I understood as I got older, when I replayed everything that was going on, because then they telepathically would tell you what's going on as you got older and I was out of body, or mm-hmm. actually encountered them again in my when I was around 7 and then 12 and then after in my 20s. But after that also, there's a lot of teleportating or, let's say, dimensional travel, soul travel with them. So I was understood. When I went on, they picked me up, carried me to the ship, which was hovering. We went up in a beam. When I got into the room inside, I was always being held in someone's arms. A lavender
where did
tone.
This beaming up. Where were you at the time when you got beamed up?
That was in Mahopac, upstate New York.
Upstate New York. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Were there any witnesses by any chance?
No, no. I snuck out of the house because I was feeling I had to go to the field, which was something you just don't do. But I did, and I ran up, and the field wasn't far from my house. It was like if you ran up to the field fast as a little kid, you could run. It would probably time it 40, 50 seconds. It wasn't that far to run for me. Maybe a minute even to get to the back field. And it was not as populated as it was today now. But still the backwoods was there. Those hills and mountains are still there the same way when I went to visit the area. And there was no lamps that you could see anything. And they hovered over the field in the back. So it
right.
was hidden by the giant school.
Right.
It's amazing when I see that.
Okay.
How it was
but
there.
Now, Mark, you realize, of course, that some people listening to this would think that you were nuts. Not myself, but you know, it almost sounds like an acid experience or something along those lines.
No, but I've had people experience it with me in England. I had friends, like 6 people went out. I prearranged it with, let's say, the space beings and told them these people were interested to be taken, teleported, or let's say astrally onto the ships. And everybody recalled and remembered the next morning everything that happened. So to this day, they still say it was the most amazing thing they ever happened to them.
Now, are you saying that that was an out-of-body kind of thing, though?
We yes, that was.
Yes, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Now, for me, physically, when we went on the ship in 58, when I was there, when the energy came around me in the room with them, it was lavender-toned, it was at that moment I felt the shifting of energy in my body. So mm-hmm. I understand now that I was somehow shifted to their frequency to them, let's say an etheric frequency, so I would have been teleported or dematerialized from physical realm, physical people here on our planet. And we took off that way and came back. And by the time I got home that night, probably around close to 11 o'clock, because it was a lighted clock on our school field, I could see the clock. So when they dropped me off, they waited until I got up from the grass where they left me, and I looked up and they were hovering over me, and then they said, now run home. And I did, and I got to my back door, and I said, how am I supposed to get sneaking past everybody in the living room? Because I couldn't climb back in the window I climbed out of. It was too high. So they said, just do it, and don't worry about it. Just go and wait. And all of a sudden, I saw the TV that was moving and sound. Everything stopped and went into still pattern like nobody would, like stop action. So I snuck in the back door, went through the living room, and everybody was in stop motion, including the dog. TV, no sound, just silence and pure love, a feeling of energy of love. And I realized, as I got older, I always asked, what the heck was that? I knew you got me through the room when I got to the bedroom. And just as I was closing the door gently, lightly, keeping it open, all sound came back and everything was back normal. So I realized they put me in between a space where they can manipulate. You can be between the spaces, I guess, is dimensionally, unseen. In a time lapse, I guess. I can't
You've taken a lot of photographs for a very long time, and I remember originally learning about you because Harold Salkin had done a story in one of the UFO magazines about your technique of taking pictures of UFOs where you would take an inexpensive camera and just hold it sort of up to the sky, and without looking through the viewfinder, being able to get apparent shots of UFOs and some interesting things. Tell us about that.
That was probably back in the early, mid-70s when I met Harold and Tim Beckley.
Yes.
And at the same time when I met them, I met Stella Lansing, who was coming to New York. So I, you know, met her and I talked with her and she was also contacting.
Now tell who Stella Lansing, a lot of people don't know who she is. Explain who she is.
Okay, she's a contactee from Massachusetts. And that's when Tim and Harold had asked, is there any contactee or people who've had experience with aliens physical in the audience? And I was the only one who raised my hand, and so they came to talk with me later, and that's how I got to meet them all.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was around 1976, 77, just around that time. So I took a camera out to the field, a little Brownie Instamatic, a 126 camera with a little flash bulb. And I just said, if I bring a camera, can you help me get a picture? And they said, go get a camera. So I got one. And when I went to the field, I said, what am I supposed to do? They said, just aim it, and we'll tell you where to aim it, and then click, we'll tell you when to click the camera. So people who had been with me in the field would see me holding a camera up to my right and talking to them, and I'd wait for the words, now. And then I'd click the camera on, and it would flash. Well, not always was there anything on film, but a lot of times you got blank film with one image.
Sure.
Or blank film with two images, and then sometimes no film, you know, just 12 shots of nothing.
Right.
And other times, what I asked for, I said one time, why don't you show me something with a probe being shot? That's a little energy ball or sphere that these entities can put out, and they'll be like monitoring people. The little probes will just watch what we do and go back. And I've seen those, and we've had one here even with an investigator who saw it in our apartment. But the thing was, is I took the camera one day and I just did that, and one of these probes appears with the under phalange of a ship. So if people go to my website, they can see the old photos. They're in it'll say older photos or something on it. Those are from the 70s, documented early photos.
Wasn't there also a photo of the, which was published in one of those magazines, of a being, what looked like a head and shoulders, perhaps, of an alien or an extraterrestrial?
I called it Alien at the Porthole. I didn't know what else to name it because every time I saw it, that's what they were telling me. This is just a silhouette at a window. The rest of the craft would be a different frequency, and they explained these things to me, which when I talked to some scientists years later, a couple years later, like there was a scientist I knew, Paul Sauvin, and Jose Gonzalez, Jose was a scientist that worked with George Van Tassel
in the
early 50s, and he told me some stories that are incredible, too. So when they saw the pictures, they were saying, wow, you know, do you know what's going on here? And I said, well, this is what they tell me. So what they were telling me was this picture has appeared on the screen, let's say a scout ship, a red scout ship, which is in the old pictures. It'll look like a red, what would you call it, a red... like a saucer shape without the upside-down saucer, a dome shape. So it's orangey color. They said, this is the ionization field, and that was picked up by your camera, which is allowed to be picked up with the frequency. Now, in there is another picture that looks like doorways are shutting and opening at the same time with something going on inside. They said, these are hatchways to a mother ship. The other thing is, the other rest of the ship is on a higher dimensional space right now because the frequency is not pulsed for your camera. And I was going, what? But okay, I get you. Okay, so the energy was the ionization field of the spaceship itself that was allowed to be shown on the film. So it came to the orange color. Then there's other pictures similar, and others with a solid look. When they were all examined in the 70s by Dr. Coleman von Kavitsky and ground saucer MUFON, actually, they found it as solid objects. Then in 1979, SBI, Scientific Bureau Investigation, with Pete Mazzola, came, and Peter Robbins was working with them, too, at that time, started out, and that's how we met Peter. They had ground saucer watch project visit with Professor Nimstow, people from ex-NASA scientists, and Coleman von Kavitsky analyzed the film in three different ways, and the cameras, too. So there were no light leaks in the cameras and no way that they could fake it or something to make it. And they said all came back as solid objects on film. And so Pete used to say, we're not going to tell them how you actually took some of these pictures, because some of the pictures were actual UFOs, but some of them were the ones that you take at the sky, and they projected on the film. So it was a fascinating experience. Today, the photos I'm taking are actual pictures of UFOs that are coming towards my apartment building, or I'm told when to go look, and they come.
Yeah, and I understand that you're
physical.
Saying to me when we spoke last night that UFOs were outside of Ingo Swann's apartment, and I believe you took photos of them?
Yes, that was May 6th and May 18th. On my birthday's May 18th.
Ingo's reaction to hearing that the UFOs were out there?
Oh, he loved that, because he was very much into this, even though I know many scientists might not know how much he was. We talked with his close friend was Jacques Vallée, and Jacques is a scientist and worked with him 19 years at the SRI and developing many of the things with the side development that's with remote viewing as well. Mm-hmm. And even then, I think Ingo was not talking too much about UFOs. He was more into paranormal. But when we were all talking, it's back in the 90s and 2000 and everything, when my relationship with my wife, with Ingo, was more of a friend, artist, UFO-ish, and out of body, we were talking about that more than remote viewing. He knew I could probably do remote viewing because I used to do stuff, but I didn't call it that. I called it mind travel, where you could sit at a table and put your mind somewhere. And I would see things and talk about it and meet people and have experiences like that and then tell the people.
Okay,
it was
now
all
for
true.
A long time, Ingo had some serious health issues. And I'm just wondering, during, let's say, the last number of years of his life, what were his interests? What were his projects or his interests? What was he working on or speaking at least about?
Well, mostly. He loved painting, and the paintings we watched him paint were the last paintings he showed us, all of the Light Bearer and Feminine Rising, and they're gigantic, beautiful paintings, very intense, and a lot of energy coming from all of Ingo's work, because he really projects into that work. We watched him do these paintings, but he was also into what's happening to the planet, like the condition of what's going on with the planet,
the
population.
What did he have to say about? I'm very interested in knowing about that. What did he say about the condition of planet Earth at this particular point in our history?
Well, that there's so many people on the planet. I think in his book, Nostradamus Chronicle or something like that. Nostradamus Effect, I think my wife said. He has some predictions in that book that actually pretty close and came right on. He said there's so many people on a planet that the planet can't sustain it, that many people, or the conditions that we do with the pollution as well as, you know, just living on the planet, and that they can't count all the people. So they might say there's like 6 million or 7 billion, but in reality, Ingo thinks there's 9 or so. And he said back in 2000, he was saying there's more. And if there's this many people, it's not good for the planet.
Right.
And so we have to take care of the planet and start, but it might be too late to start, but at least they're starting, you know, trying to do more of organics and not using pollution with the gasoline products and all this.
Well,
so
besides the
sustainable
problems that have been caused by mankind, did he relate to the environmental catastrophes, the earth changes that have been happening? That seemed to be natural in origin?
Yeah, just a little bit, because he felt, but we all would probably feel the same thing with this planet beautiful planet we have here, with so many people and so much going on with it, and their warfare and bombs and everything that's going on, creates an imbalance, like the Koryanastachi, you know, with the Hopi. So it's planet out of balance. So, yes, it would cause earthquakes or different things to happen. And he would study that information with the earthquake and with his people around the planet that he knows, other scientists. So they would fax each other, you know, because Ingo didn't have a computer in his house.
Really?
He wouldn't allow it.
Wow. Yeah, well, he was his own. He used his mind's computer, right?
Well, he has a website and a webmaster. He was a wonderful guy, but he doesn't have the computer. He might have had a typewriter thing, like a computer that can just type and not hooked up to an internet.
Yeah.
Because
a couple of years ago,
computer.
Mark, the Mayan elders who I was working with on an event called the Legend of the 13 Crystal Skulls, which is a very successful event that was held over at FIT Auditorium here in New York City.
Yeah, we were there. We were all there.
That's right. Now they had predicted that UFOs would be seen, and lo and behold, a week later, there were what were described as UFOs. All the news media were on it. It was basically objects that were seen and photographed above the Chelsea area. Did you ever get down to see those UFOs? You see them on TV? I mean, they were claiming, news media was claiming that that there were just balloons, but balloons don't shut three area airports, and that happened for many hours. I was just wondering what your take is on that flap that happened here in New York 2 years ago.
Yeah, that was interesting. Also, I got some UFO pictures that next few days, too. So I believe, yes, why not? Because I've seen things like that that look... I have binoculars with me when I'm when I'm with me, so I can always see if these balloons are not, because they are so high up, you can't see the thread. But with binoculars, you could see it. And many times, if I see something in a group, which I've seen the group balloons come over, and in the distance, they look really cool over here. This past summer, I guess a wedding of balloons came out from maybe Botanical Garden. So they came over the park, but there were threads all over those. The ones that they had that day back in 2010 didn't look like they were exactly balloons, but they mimicked them in some ways, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't there for that. I was up here where I live. But I wasn't surprised to hear about it, though.
Yeah,
you know?
There's been more and more UFO activity starting this last year in 2012, more than there's ever been, really. And if you look on YouTube, of course, many of them are fakes, but many of them aren't.
Yeah,
and there's some very compelling videos on YouTube. They seem to be coming somewhat closer, perhaps as we're more open to accepting them. I'm wondering, what would you need to do, and do you think there is anything that you can do to get them to come a little closer in terms of picture taking?
The thing is, when we're up in the fields in the country area, they come closer. But in the city, they don't seem to come as close.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, rarely they do. And people have taken some pictures of spheres, which are kind of common around here right now. The spheres that are silver, white, or dark gray, or blue, or look like pearls, which we've taken pictures. They look like a shining pearl. And they will follow you as well. But they also dematerialize. And one of those came over your house during your party.
It sure did. That was very interesting. That was, maybe about a year ago at least, maybe longer than that.
Yeah, maybe 2 years now almost.
Yeah.
Huh.
Said that you had gotten some kind of a message and that they would be making an appearance, and sure enough, there was something.
One came
above our terrace here. And what was interesting, of course, was that most of the people attending the party, many of the people who were attending the party, were UFO aficionados. So
that's right. And your friend Mark saw them.
Mark did see them. Now, also, by the way, I just learned this. Two red UFOs were sighted minutes before the blackout at the Super Bowl. And the International Business Times ran the story, I believe, together with a video clip of that event. That's unbelievable. I mean, that's right out of the movie, the original Day the Earth Stood Still scenario.
Wow. Was that this Super Bowl just now?
It just happened.
Oh, I'm tough to look at. I didn't know that. I was.
Yeah. As soon as it just came out, I was going to leave with it.
That's cool.
It's extraordinary. Just amazing.
Well, they've been saying to me for years now, and many, many years, actually 30 some odd years, but that times would get, they'll be coming closer and closer as people become more aware and start to tune up or think towards them in love, in light, you know, trying to be as helpers. Not all beings are negative and not all beings are here to hurt people. Most of them are benevolent and trying to raise our consciousness or get us to think that there's more than you expect. There's more to
Is there anything
hear.
That we can do about any, I mean, this is a vast universe. There are obviously some unfriendly beings out there, too. There's got to be. I mean, you just walk around New York City, there are unfriendly beings in the human variety.
Well, so, I'll tell you one thing that they've always told me when I was a little child, when they said, I asked them about something like that, and they said, if you ever see a spaceship or a UFO, let's say, in a dark red, not ruby bright orange red, but dark red, like dark red.
Those are the ones to avoid.
Do not look at it and do not send any thoughts to it. They said, just ignore it. But they were saying that came from those kind of dimensional space, or those beings are working with that frequency.
Right.
But that was one thing they said. But they also said, when you attune two of them, if you look towards a spaceship, if you see something hovering in the sky, telepathically send out a thought of oneness, brotherhood, sisterhood, love, and talk to it telepathically and say, I see you. Are you? Do you see me? If you do, can you just go up and down for a yes, back and forth for a no? I used to do that with the kids, and they would see that. But for me, it was telepathic. I would hear them, but to train people, they can do that. They are watching, observing us at all times, these different benevolent beings. And they watch the planet. They see whose auras are high in energy, and they will try to communicate in a sense or show up so you follow you or make you look up at the right time and see them hovering above you. And that's part of the things I used to try to teach people about when they come to my talks and stuff. So it's
right.
Like if you feel them, if you feel something, look. Don't, you know, just look. And if there's something there, say hello and send out a thought of love, like brother-sister love, and you should get a response similar back, going a friendly response, and then they might just take off or dematerialize. If you get a feeling to look somewhere up and there's nothing in the sky that you see, don't be surprised. They are there, invisibly monitoring just to test us, because like they said, we're always testing to see who's hearing and listening, because mankind has put plugs in their ears and they're distracted. They don't hear anymore and they don't think anymore to look around. So they suggest people start listening into your intuitive abilities and training yourself to think
have
higher.
Have they ever indicated to you, Mark, about their concern about that they're going to blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons? Because
Yes. They've
certainly been spotted at nuclear weapons storage facilities, and they've even changed codes, and they definitely have shown a clear intent
with those
weapons.
That's true. That's true. And back in the 70s, they also were hovering over a ship. I remember reading out of that story, China testing a bomb under the ocean, and
right.
A UFO would come out of the sky, hover over the spot, and the bomb wouldn't detect. They couldn't push the button or wouldn't work when they pushed it. And it was three times it wouldn't detonate, and finally they gave up. It kept coming up, going into the cloud, coming down, going to the cloud, and coming down, hovering. It was like they're trying to tell people, you don't know what's in this, what you're doing. You don't understand humans, you know, things like that. Get the message. So that's kind of what it's about, really.
Now, what do you see your role as being in all of this? I mean, you've been doing this for a very long time. Where do you think things are going?
Well, if people believe in reincarnation, I feel and have felt as a child all the time that it was not from here, and that the people or beings I'm in contact with are basically people I've been with. They're my friends, friends from different places, from another time. And Ingo also knew that about me and saw that when he first met me. So he said, oh, I see, this is you. You know, you're not from here. And so I think that's what helped connect us. And from that point, it was like the father affection feeling I had for a father with Ingo. And so I think he knew that, and he admitted it with me, too. You know, he's smiling. Yeah, I know. Yep. So we had that connection. So it was more with art, love, and space. And whenever I bring a photo over of UFOs, he would go, oh, there they are. And so when they came over his house that time in 2012, in May, we were right there. We went upstairs and showed him on the cameras what we just took. And he said, oh, there they are. Oh, that's them. And he would put his hand on the film, on the camera, you know. So he he was always interested, but in the last few years or so, he wasn't getting around as much walking outside, and I think he enjoyed seeing whatever we could find, but would come over, and we'd go down and visit with him a lot, and show him the latest pictures, and he would send a picture to Jacques Vallée, let's say, and then he would have that picture. It was just this whole thing that we were doing, and so much love. He was the most remarkable person I've ever met on this planet.
What is going to happen to all of his wonderful paintings? These are very large canvases, and they're very futuristic.
His family is trying to set up an art gallery, a museum, where somehow they'll be seen as a whole gallery, and also maybe have access to the written books he's made, maybe digitally, so people can come in and read them and see them. And on March 2nd, this coming March 2nd, there's going to be a memorial tribute that we're helping the family with putting together for Ringo.
Where is that going to be held?
And that'll be the Nicholas Warwick Museum, 107th Street.
Will that be open to the public?
Well, it is, I guess, now, because many people know about it, but originally it was for people who knew Ingo, who were close to him, or knew who worked with him in some way, but I think the word is already out. So we've been helping the family set that up for him.
Sure.
And there'll be a restaurant on the street, 107, too, that people
very
meet
great.
Up to.
Mark, I want to thank you very much for being with us tonight on Starship One Radio. If people want to see your photographs and of UFOs and your artwork, where do they go?
Okay, thanks, Mike. They go to intergalacticmission.com, and you'll see new photographs. That'll be the latest.
Okay,
intergalacticmission.com. And then lectures I'm doing.
Yes.
Then there's a lecture I'll be doing on February 20th at the Meta Center.
Oh, yeah. And also, before we go, just give the title of the film that you're part of.
The Hidden Hand by James Carman.
Yes.
And James is a wonderful, wonderful guy. Great, like a big brother, like a little brother to me, everything.
Yeah, I met him. How can people see that film?
I think people see the film when James is going to show it right now. He hasn't got it. It's not something to buy yet.
Right. Well, we'll announce it on the show if we know about it in advance. We'll certainly announce it on the show. Yeah, James is a really good guy, very creative guy.
His website is timetravelerarts.com, so maybe there's links in there, or at least titled The Hidden Hand by James Carman. Maybe you could see something that way where he might be setting it up, again. He does them throughout the universe. That was good. I was going to say the universe. The Earth, he goes around different times, different states maybe. So somewhere in New York it might be again shown.
Okay. Thanks again very much, Mark. I'll have to have you back sometime soon. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Starship One Radio, the Cosmic Superforce in broadcasting. The show's the successor to Radio Doomsday Live. So we're now called Starship One Radio. We're on every Thursday night at 12 midnight Eastern Time on bbsradio.com on station number 2. And this is Mike Luckman signing off.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes, an airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I am a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world to its own needs. Dummies of your own needs. Beat it up a notch. Speak front. No strings. No matter. Start to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire in a fire. Rivers in the 7 games. In the government for hire. In a combat site. Let the weapon come in a hurry with the fury. Speed it down. You're